I thought maybe the spinning action of this antenna was not going to work out. But they said it's the amplifier that quit, and they're trying to figure out why. So this high-power amplifier, I think it was 500 watts or something, shooting a signal down, hitting the earth, roughly 500 mile swaths every time it was going over land or water. So apparently that thing is out. They have some kind of a passive detector on board they're still going to use, but the main one with the amplifier is out of business. A couple of other things I think I want to cover, but I think, you know, for now that's good enough. I think there's been some launches, launch from Cape Canaveral for the military, put a satellite into geosynchronous orbit. Russia sent a Proton rocket up, which I'm glad they've had some problems with their Proton rocket. And we now have another crew, a total of 9 now on the International Space Station. That went up last week as well. A lot of launches going up, a lot of things to happen in the future. But this is Space Net Report 165. Any questions? Back to you, Dick.
Brief line, Paul. When it comes to those 0.625-18 volts, 18 threads per inch, I think is national fine instead of national coarse. So I think that's a standard American volt. You may have heard that John and I had a considerable discussion that I think went on for more than an hour in the wee hours of the morning a couple of days ago about how much force is on those bolts on the 54-inch square berthing holes where these two modules get connected together. We had a considerable discussion on that. We slowly came to a conclusion that the bolts were more than strong enough. And now you told us that they've done experiments or a study where one of the 16 bolts can fail, and you still have a good seal. I suspect that if two bolts side by side failed, life would get kind of dicey. However, they're probably high-strength bolts, probably grade 6 or grade 8 bolts. And the thing that I was always worried about is that there's 16 individual motors moving to 16 bolts, and all those motors have got to do just the right thing. If one of those motors decides not to run that bolt all the way into that blind hole, you're berthing two items together. I think life would get very, very complicated. I guess the cosmonauts, astronauts, we drop.
In canal 718, by the way, very, very strong steel.
Wow. Is that this fancy kind of steel that's got 150 or 160,000 pounds per square inch of capability? Is that the kind of steel we're talking about here, Paul?
I didn't look up the tensile strength on it, but you know, it's just, I mean, they use it for aerospace, and they use the same Inconel metal in inside of rocket engines to protect the chambers. So I mean, even today, SpaceX is using it. A lot of people. It was used in the F1 rocket and on the Saturn V rocket, you know, and it just, and well, of course, when they use them for bulbs, and by the way, they're shaped, they're cut like on a 45, they're rounded, John, I know you asked about that as well, this way they can catch very easily, and each bulb has the motor attached to it, and the motors are made by Honeywell, by the way. Each one has its individual motor. They're all controlled by computer setup. They're all torqued down, all 16 bolts to 1,500 pounds, and then they let it sit for a couple of hours and let the heat builds up every time you do this, and they let the heat equalize, and then they do it again, maybe four at a time, and eventually they bring each one up to roughly 10,000 pounds, so you know, it takes a series of moves, you know, they don't just make them all up at one time. Back to you, Dick.
So 10,000 pounds of tensile strength on the tightening of each bolt, 16 of also up to about 160,000 pounds of capability here for holding back. I vaguely remember we're talking about 30,000 pounds has to be held back. Now, I'm guessing these 16 motors, tightening these 16 bolts, are 16-year motors, which the actual armature of the motor is moving at one rate, but the bolt is moving at a much slower rate.
Around 1,200 to 1, Dick.
Okay. Is that that gear motor is most likely a planetary gear system motor, similar to what you've got in a prop pitch motor, which I think also runs some crazy number like a 10,000 to 1 ratio on a prop pitch motor. Any idea what the ratio is on that bolt?
Yeah, it's 1,200 to 1 on the, it really geared down, and I think the RPMs were initially 5 per minute, and that's what, you know, when they were doing the 1,500 pounds, and when they go up to the high numbers, it's like, you know, a half a turn per minute or something like that. So tremendous force. And the same unit, the same motor setup, almost the same, that drives these actuators. You know, when it gets the spacecraft get close to one another, they have these, they call them the hooks and latches, and they, the active part grabs a whole lot of passive part. The passive part is always a piece that's coming up, parts on the International Space Station are the active ones, and they're able to pull it in with these motors. The motors almost look the same. The only difference is, you know, one's hooked up to these hook type of devices that pull it back in. And then they have pins for alignment, camera right through the middle of the door that they can see. And then after that, you know, after the flanges are faced to one another, then they start in with this bulb setup. As you can see, it takes a long time to either bulb it up or disconnect it. So that's why one of the reasons you can never use this for an emergency for a regular spacecraft. This is all done, you know, with a robotic arm holding things on the outside, holding it in place. Back to you, sir.
Yeah, the nice thing about these two modules being brought together in a berthing arrangement and the 16 bolts is that in theory it's only got to be connected once. It's not something you're going to take apart 50 times. But although these motors that are connecting these bolts have got extremely high reliability and they're very beefy and they're combined with a lot of reserve, a lot of conservativeness. I know it's a difficult question, Paul, but is there a backup procedure if one or two of those motors failed in some way during the time you're trying to permanently berth two separate modules? And by some means, you have to reach inside of a module that is not yet berthed. Therefore, the inner door in the existing portion of the International Space Station, the inner door is closed with its pyramid-shaped support ribs, stiffening ribs. But if a motor failed and you want to go to a manual backup, which implies to me that an astronaut has got to get in there, so you'd have to close down doors and other sections of the International Space Station. Let me drop.
They got a plan where you don't need to do an EVA there.
I was about to ask, when you need a manual backup because a bolt motor didn't fire, one procedure I can think of is that you would down pressurize the existing space station module after closing off doors and get an astronaut with a spacesuit on. That's one approach. And I guess another approach is an EVA where you enter the other end of the new module being installed, but is there a manual backup by which you can operate one of the 16 bolt motors if one of them fails? WS2N, K2RIW.
Well, the motors are accessible on the inside. That's why it's designed where the active portions, you know, you have, these things are called common berthing mechanisms, CBM. So they have the active CBMs and the passive CBMs. The active ones are on the space station. The passive one would be, let's say, a visiting vehicle. and let's say one failed, most likely it's not going to, you know, might be a bad plug or something like that. That's accessible with the closed doors on the inside of the space station. You know, there's panels there that can get to it. But if they had to, you know, try to fix a thread or something, that would be impossible. But most likely it would be something like that. My guess, they also, I mean, looking at these units, they could probably disconnect one of these motors. If that failed, they'd probably put a new one on. You know, it's a module. You know, just looks like a module with a place to plug it in, and that goes all to the computers. So that's the way it looks like it's designed. Anything more than that, I think they'd be in trouble. But again, they have disconnected these things a number of times. You know, for instance, they bolted together the PMA, pressure mating adapter number 3, the Unity at one time. Well, it's been disconnected, and it's been bolted to Harmony. Let me drop it. That was just like, you know, 2, 3, 4 months or something like that before they made that move. And they've disconnected a couple of other modules as well. But the one I was concerned about was the one they did this year, earlier this year. Scott Kelly was involved in it. He's now, by the way, the commander of the space station with 9 people on board. He's the one up there for the 1-year mission. You know, him and, you know, the other American astronaut, their job was to disconnect the MMP, the multi-purpose module, MPM, multi-purpose module. One of the big freaking modules, just like all the rest of them. They had to disconnect it, have the robotic arm bring it all the way over to Tranquility, and then rebolt it up there. So, the process took all day long, and it was successful. But I was wondering, because this thing was up there for like 3 years, you know, are these bolts going to come apart? And they had no problem. I did that.
Yeah, you just gave me a piece of information that gives me a warm, fuzzy feeling. I didn't realize that the motors that are tightening the bolts are already on the inside of the existing module on the International Space Station. And the new module being brought up is the one that doesn't have the motors on that interface. But I imagine the back end of the new module has a set of motors so that another module could be added at a later time. So the motors are already in the pressurized portion of the International Space Station. While you're docking the new module, which already has this cone-shaped door closed on it until all the docking is finished, pressurization is checked and so on. So that gives you access to those motors, and now you have the possibility of doing a manual override to force the motor by some means. Because I thought the motors would be on the inside the module, in which case to get there to operate a faulty motor would be very difficult. A huge procedure. Out of curiosity, Paul, the bolts that hold, let me drop them. 16 5/8 by 18 bolts that hold the existing module to the new module that's being joined at this docking port. 16 bolts. Are there any extra holes? If you wanted to add some extra bolts for some reason to the 16 bolts, is that the only? You got pig stickers, making sure you got alignment pins to make sure everything comes together just right. Then you operate those 16 motors. And they're in the environment with the astronauts. And they can sit there and listen to them operate, watch the dials turn, and whatever. Out of curiosity, from either direction, are there any auxiliary blind bolt holes that could be used if for some reason you wanted backup? WS2N, K2RIW.
I've looked at a number of these flanges, and I've never seen any extra holes. I've counted them many times, and tried to do what you recommended, try to size it up. Impossible, you know. I mean, I was guessing at 5/8 on something like that. Sure enough, it's turned out to be 5/8. But I've never seen any extra holes, Dick. And of course, if it's a spacecraft like eventually this new Starliner by Boeing coming up with. with a crew, that's different. They're going to go to a docking port. But if it's maybe it's going to be the star lineup version. Eventually, they probably want to make a cargo version. That would go to a berthing module like we're talking about. SpaceX, they've done it many times. They've come up with the spacecraft, and you open up the door on one side. Naturally, you don't need anything on the inside of the spacecraft because you're not going to build out. But if it's a module, it's going to be built, you know, to it. Yeah, then you would need another door or so. The nodes, node 1, 2, and 3, that's Unity, Harmony, and Tranquility, all have 6 doors. So that's pretty amazing. I mean, I was counting them one time, and it's got to be over 20 doors throughout this whole thing. Incredible.
Now, as I see it, each module has on the face of the module, where there is a berthing port, where a new module is about to be added, the motors are on the inside. And the motors have bolts that are going to stick from that existing module into the new module. Therefore, the existing module, I'm going to call that the male interface, and the new module berthing port, I'm going to call that the female interface. So each individual module has what I call a male interface and a female interface. And therefore, you can keep building the system as long as you like. And I believe, I'm going to make a rough guess now, that the International Space Station end-to-end is something like 150 feet end-to-end, in that order. And up till now, we've been calculating the stress on those bolts in order to hold back 14.7 pounds per square inch of air pressure. And that comes out to be something like 30,000 pounds, as I remember. Let me drop it. However, there's something else to worry about here. When I've got 150-foot-long structure made out of these individual modules, Zestia, Zarya, TM, I forget what that one is, Unity, Destiny, Harmony, and so on. You add all these modules together. That's a very long cantilever. If now I go to the end of that structure, and I connect the International Space Station, I connect a progress module or whatever, and if I do any stressing of the module side by side, not end view, but I start taking that module that I'm connecting at the end, and I push up, down, left, or right, I'm now creating a great big bending moment to this 150-foot-long structure. That the only thing holding all of these modules together on each individual interface is 16 bolts. Bending moment I could add to that whole structure could be a great big number. Are any of the modules connected by any other kind of external truss beams or whatever? Is there anything else creating stiffening of this whole International Space Station very long structure? Is nothing holding all the modules together but each of the modules, 16 bolts, Paul? WS2N, K2LIW, and the TechNet?
Roughly half the space, a little over half the space station is in a livable part, so it's done with berthing modules. And naturally, they're all over the place. Not only are they in line, but they also go off, on a 90 degree angle from this in line to pick up other modules. And then what's interesting enough is, yeah, this whole setup is a little over 200 feet long, going, I hate to use the word bisecting, which makes it look like it's going through it, but, at a 90-degree angle, well, you've seen the space station, you've got this truss section, this 320 feet long, with solar panels and everything sticking off the end of it, so that is not attached with the berthing setup. I mean, they're all bolted together, but the way that connects to the International Space Station is via Discovery. Discovery is the American module, and it's not berthed. It's all angle lines. I'm going to call them. They call them trusses, but they look like big, heavy-duty angle lines to me. But there's four of them, and that's how it's bolted to the Discovery. That's it. I mean, it's amazing. I agree with you. It looks like you got to be kidding. Like you need some kind of something coming out of a 45 or something to support this thing. But now it's, this is the way it's done. I guess they feel it's that strong, each module. Back you there.
Wow. So it's 200 feet long. I think the longest dimension is the one from Zvezda toward Destiny. That length is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 or 8 modules. Wow. Each one of those modules is roughly the length of the cargo hold of the space shuttle. Because that's the way I think some of them were brought up in the beginning. But that's a very long structure. I'm amazed they didn't put some external beams acting as stiffeners. If the only thing connecting all the modules together are the 16 volts of each berthing interface, that's... Huh.
It gets a little flimsy.
Yeah.
Let me tell you.
I wonder if the astronauts can stand at one end and do what I do on my radio tower. When I go on the top of my tower and I push my body closer and further away from the tower, I can set the tower in oscillation. I can bend it, so to speak, even though it's very high-strength steel. And so I wonder if an astronaut could go at one end of Discovery or one end of Zvezda, and he moves himself left and right. Can he feel the bending of the structure? Over to you, Paul.
You know, when they exercise inside, they have their, you know, this jogging thing that they have, and it's all on springs and everything, and shock absorbers, and it's not permanently attached to a Discovery. It's kind of like floating, you know. And the reason for it is when you're running, they don't want to set up residence and start shaking the ends of the solar panels all the way out. Yeah, and it was like the reason I said half of the living quarters, once you get to the Russian side, it gets flimsier. They have, well, their connections are being made by docking style type of hookups. That's why they you don't see the big squares where they are. Everything that, you know, the square door, they have, you know, on a, you know, the functioning cargo block, and then says the, and then you come out from different ports, the piers and the raster, and these are different modules that come out from the Russians. Those things are all, they've been docked. It's not a berthing situation. So you have roughly a 31, 32 inch diameter hole that you can slide through from one end to the other. So at one end you got Zvezda, the Russian part of the side of it, and that's docked, literally docked, not berthed. So it's got a 30 inch, well, naturally it's probably about 36 inch flange connection, and that's bolted to the functioning cargo block. That's another very long
repeater timeout. Repeater timeout. Cancel.
That's a very long module by the Russians. It's again, that's attached with a docking setup that the Russians use. None of this bolt thing. And then after that, they have the pressure mating adapter one, and that gets us to American side, the opposite end of pressure mating adapter. That's why they call it an adapter. It's going from the docking style from that the Russians use to the berthing system that we use. That side now starts with the 16 volts, and now you come down the line. You know, that piece is attached to Unity. That's a six-ported node, connecting node, and then that's attached to Destiny, and then forward of that is you're attached to another module called that's another node with six different ports on it, called Tranquility. And now out from that, yeah, you know, that's the whole run. And then out from actually in the front of Tranquility, you also have another pressure mating adapter number two. Just sitting there, that's where, getting ready to be used. That's where they wanted to attach the, you know, the front of that is a docking setup, not a berthing setup. That's why they call them adapters. Pressure rating adapter one is where they, number two is where they're going to eventually dock Dragon and this new Starliner by Boeing. The last rocket that was coming up that SpaceX was going to bring up, they had this international docking adapter built, you know, built by Boeing, that NASA wanted to put on the front of pressure mating adapter number one, which will, you know, is this new version of a docking setup for all the new spacecraft that's going to be coming up on the American side. So that's the whole run of this thing. It's a long run, but it's interesting. Quite an engineering piece, Dick. Now, you go back to Discovery, and Discovery is attached to, like I said, Unity. And Unity has, above that, it's got, they call it the Z1 Truss. The Z1 Truss was designed to just temporarily really hold another truss that was up there in the beginning of all these flights, and that had one big solar panel on it. That supplied power for a long time until they started building out the space station. Eventually, that whole big truss section, they call it P6, with its big solar arrays, was transferred all the way to the port side, and then Z1 was left there. Z1 has a berthing connection, and you could actually go into Z1, and there's some equipment in there, they decided not to use that. They've got these, I call them angle irons, struts that are attached to zero. They call it number. It's actually the middle piece is called zero. And then they go 1, 3, 5, 7, 1, 3, 5, and 6 to the starboard side. 1, 3, 5, and 6 to the port side. You notice I left number two out. It's not that I can't count. They didn't put in number two. Back to you, Dick.
Well, roughly 1 million pounds of hardware, roughly 200 and some odd feet long. And when you look at that length of Zvezda, Zarya, pressure module number one, Unity, Destiny, Harmony, pressure module number two, Discovery, just along one particular direction. I think that's the direction where there's close to 200 feet. Something like, you're going to correct me on this, something like four times a year, we have to do a little bit of boosting of the International Space Station to make sure it stays at the right altitude, because it's experiencing continuous atmospheric drag. Even though it's way, way above the atmosphere, there's still a little bit of atmosphere out there, particularly during periods of high solar activity. There's an atmosphere that goes, the atmosphere of the Earth actually puffs out during high solar activity periods. Let me drop. So, many of your visiting spacecraft, it used to be the International, it used to be the Space Shuttle, nowadays I guess it's Progress. The visiting, refurbishing spacecraft have to do some boosting. And so, in order for the boosting to actually boost you in velocity, but not create a twist, I'm guessing that boosting is done in view. In other words, I'm guessing you attach to Discovery, do the boosting, or you get attached to Zvezda. I'm going to guess Discovery. So you attach your boosting spacecraft to Discovery, and it pushes this whole thing in view, the longest dimension, and hopefully doesn't create any twist in the process of the boosting. Otherwise, the twist would set you in rotational motion. And another question I've got is, are there any onboard thrusters that can be used? If for some reason the visiting spacecraft are not going to come up for the next 6 months, and you just happen to have enough consumables on board, that's not a problem. But you want to do some boosting. Are there any thrusters on board that can do the boosting? And I'm going to guess that the thrusting on board is very minor compared to the boosting you could get from a visiting spacecraft. So, you can see I've got a whole series of questions of how you do boosting. WS2N, K2RIW, what a machine.
Okay, Dick, we're gonna have to start another International Space Station net, because there's not enough time, that's what's going to happen. The thrusting is all done from Zvezda right now, or actually from a Progress ship that's attached to Zvezda. In the back of Zvezda is a docking port for the Russians. So here comes this Progress spacecraft, especially when it's designed with plenty of fuel. There's two Progresses. One that primarily has food and clothes, and it uses its engine to push the whole setup forward. It's attached to Zvezda. First of all, you got to think of the space station as like an airplane. The front of the airplane with all these modules is the American side and the European ESA, the European Space Agency side. That's the front side. That's the tail side. We're going to call that the Russian side. So it's always being pushed generally from the back to increase the speed of the space station and gain altitude. So the Progress will dock to the back of the Zvezda, fire its engine. Or you might have another Progress that comes up primarily, it'll have, stuff, food and water, but it'll also have a lot of tanks inside that have fuel in it. Well, they attach to these ports built into the docking ring, and they can flow fuel to the Zvezda. Zvezda has these tanks, fill up the tanks, and then Zvezda has rocket engines on the back of that to, where the Progress is not there. And
repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
And moves the space station. You'll notice when I was talking before, I said, the zero truss section is the one in the middle attached to Discovery. When you go out to the port side and to the starboard side, you go to number one, there's no number two, number three, four, five, and six. The other way, you have the same thing. One, there's number two, three, four, five, and six. The reason they did away with two at one time was planned. They were going to have thrusters and everything, tanks and stuff on these two segments. They were going to have this was going to fire, and not only you were going to have the Russian side, but you were going to have the American side attached to these thrust segments that was going to be able to accelerate the space station forward. They've done away with that because the Russian side was good enough. We could talk about other modules that come off of this, but we're really talking about the run of the modules. There's other modules, of course, that come off the whole run of all of these back to there.
Yeah, I've drawn this beautiful diagram that you've been giving me this data on over the last few weeks, Paul. And because the Zvezda, I'm guessing, was one of the early modules, although maybe I'm wrong there, I assume that was the front end of the vehicle when it's moving. Because my diagram starts at Zvezda, goes through Zarya, pressure mating adapter, Unity, Destiny, Harmony, pressure mating adapter, Discovery. I assume that that was front to back. Actually, it's back to front. Now getting the impression that Discovery is the leading edge when the thing is flying through space, and Zvezda is the back end, that's the tail, and it's where you do the pushing. So I have the diagram backwards as far as flight is concerned. Okay. Which flies to the right on my diagram, not to the left.
You got to improve on that, Dick. A little off.
Okay. I can only tolerate so much. My next question is, if Progress does some of the boosting, what's your guess as to how many pounds of thrust, what length of time can Progress do boosting? And when you fill up the tanks, the rocket engine tanks in Zvezda, and you let it do the boosting, how many pounds of thrust for how long can it do boosting? And is boosting done, let me pick a number, four times per year? Tell me about boosting. WS2N, K2RIW. There's no end to these questions, Paul.
Yeah, boosting is done anytime you send a Progress spacecraft up there. And they were doing it quite a bit with the ATV, the automatic trans vehicles. And that, of course, is now, out the window. They did their five flights, no more. That was great. They were about three times the size of the Progress. You're right. The back end is the Russian side, So you got Zvezda, Zarya, they also call it the functioning cargo block. They refer to it as that as well. But it's Zepsa, Zarya. You've got the pressure mating adapter number one attached to Unity. Unity's a, I mean, that's, you know, I call it a node, but I mean, it's a, they're big modules. They have sleeping quarters in there. Then you go to the next one, which is, that's attached to Destiny. We're still going forward. Now you're going to go to another module, which is even bigger than Unity, called Harmony. Okay, Harmony, it's another node. In front of that, you have the pressure mating adapter number two. That's the one that will eventually pick up incoming spacecraft. So now, just back up a little bit, go back to Harmony. If you go straight down to the Nadir, or the Earth-facing port coming out of Harmony, you've got a big module sticking in there right now, and that's only temporarily. It's a spacecraft. It's built by Japan. It's called the H-2, and it's there right now, and they're still unloading it. They'll be doing a...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Pushing in about another month or two. Couple months. Back to you there.
Do we know the approximate amount of thrust in pounds that Progress, I'm guessing one of the major boosters these days is Progress vehicle. How many pounds of thrust can Progress apply for what length of time? That's not one I know. And when Zvezda does its own boosting, how many pounds of thrust for what length of time can it do thrusting? Over to you, Paul, K2LAW.
Hey, Fred, I don't know, like 20 or 30 minutes at a time, sometimes these things go, and then they have to do it again soon afterwards on the other side of Earth. By the time they, you know, it starts, you know, what happens is it starts to send them into an elliptical orbit, so they'll have to do it again for another 20 minutes or so. But long periods of time, the same with the with Zeta. I guess there's not much pressure coming out there. That's what I'm saying. If you push them down, now we're getting back to what you said. If you push in the middle of this thing, you know, I know there's no gravity up there, but you're going to put some, if it was a sudden stress on this whole run, you would put some kind of stress on the thrust segments, So they probably, I know they could throttle these rocket engines. And my guess is they start off low and maybe they build up more, I don't know. But they run for many minutes at a time. And then there's a planned module coming up eventually to replace, more or less replace Zesta, or at least assist with it in case the rocket engines fail. And it's built by the Russians. It's been planned for years. And, plenty of money has, to do this, but it, for a lot of reasons, they've never gotten it up there, and that's going to attach to one of the modules, and that's going to have rocket engines on as well. But there's the rocket engines that were on this unit sitting in a factory in Russia somewhere. It's been so many years that one of the lines developed a leak. Let's take it all apart and want to send up new rockets when this thing finally goes up, and they stripped out everything and not rebuilding that. Eventually, Zesda will have some help. I mean, these rockets have been firing on and off since 2001. Well, actually, it's probably 2000 since they sent that thing up there. Let's see, Zesda probably was here around 2000, maybe 1999. Back to you.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned the fact that they do the boosting twice. And there's a name for that. It's called the Hohmann Transfer Orbit. Hohmann is pronounced H-O-H-M-A-N-N. This guy Hohmann discovered that when it comes to raising the orbit of something, assuming you're doing a short duration burn compared to the orbital period, that place where you do the burn, if you're doing a prograde burn, used to be a beautiful circular orbit that now is going to be an elliptical orbit, but the place where you did the burn is now the perigee, increased the velocity there, which means the orbit, as it continues with the new higher velocity, is going to go to a greater altitude on the backside of the Earth, so to speak, 45 minutes later. That's now going to be the apogee. And so you always come back to the place where you did the burn, if it's a brief burn. So you do a burn to create a higher apogee on the backside of the Earth. Then at that apogee, you do another burn, which raises the perigee where you used to be up to the new apogee. And now you recircularize. So minimum energy required for raising the orbit is this dual burn on opposite sides of the orbit called a Hohmann maneuver. And it turns out that Professor Campolo of Hofstra University, you and I know him as K-A-2-Y-H-Y, Steve, he and I get together once in a while in the morning and in the evening as he's on his way to college or on the way home or from his place of business. Let me drop. And when it comes to orbital mechanics, we know that the moon has a an increase. The moon recedes from the Earth 1.5 inches, 3.82 centimeters, 1.5 inches per year. The moon is moving out, away from us. And so I did a calculation. I mean, I may believe that Steve and I are running this rocket engine company. We're making the world's most best ion engines. And so now we're going to install a ion engine on the right side of the moon, pushing it in order to increase the orbit of the moon, to do this lunar recession, 1.5 inches per year. Assume the tides stop doing it for some reason. Let me drop. So the calculation is, well, how much increase in velocity? The moon moves at around 1,000 meters per second, 2,300 miles an hour is the moon's velocity around the Earth. So it's moving at around 1,000 meters per second. And in order to make it go out 1.5 inches, we have to increase its velocity, what looks like an increase in velocity on a Hohmann maneuver, of 80 nanometers per second. It's moving 1,000 meters per second, and you're going to add 80 nanometers to that. Very little velocity increase. And now it'll move out 1.5 inches. So at first it would sound like very little force is required, and because the rocket engine we're manufacturing could easily do that. Well, not a chance. The moon is a very heavy object. To even speed it up by 50 nanometers per second of increase in velocity out of 1,000, what is that? That's 1 part in 10 to the 12. You're increasing its velocity by 1 part in 10 to the 12. It's a very small change in velocity in order to move it out to 1.5 inches. So I think you're saying that around 4 or so boosts per year of the International Space Station by way of Progress or anybody else who visits. And by the way, is anybody else doing boosting but Progress these days? I mean, do we do most of the boosting with Progress and you save the fuel on Zeus unless you need a backup boost because nobody's visiting for a while? How do they arrange that? So who does all the boosting? Is it only done by Progress, Paul? WS2N, K2IW?
Channel used to do it. Progress, and then for what, 6 years in a row, the ATV, the automatic transfer vehicle by the European Space Agency, that was launched from French Guiana, an average of once a year. They've canceled that. That was launching on the Ariane rocket. That was a good deal. Unfortunately, that's come to an end. So right now, you only have Progress. And Soyuz, sometimes they'll actually use the Soyuz rocket. Kind of weird. But, I mean, they need those for the crews to get back. So it's primarily, if they had to, they could use the Soyuz. They just, they did an emergency one a couple of months ago, because of some debris, which put the space station into a higher orbit. And that's why the new spacecraft that went up there with the 3 people, now you have 9 on board, had to take the 2-day route instead of the 6-hour route, because the space station was a little higher in orbit, and it wasn't planned on, you know, with the weight and everything that they were bringing up, it was, you know, they couldn't change that. So they went back to the 2-day deal to dock with the space station. There you go. I guess I could look up the progress thrusters, see what kind of, how many newtons of force they use. You know, I mean, it's not a lot, but like I said, they'll fire it for a half hour and it's enough to get them going. Back to you, Dick.
If they fire for a half hour, that's a significant portion of the orbit. The orbit is 90 minutes total. That's an hour and a half. Getting close. If you fired continuously, you wouldn't have to do a Holman maneuver if you fired for the whole orbit.
Okay, wait. To do with the Bessemer engine.
Yeah, and I'm also amazed that they would use a, I can't think of the name of it now, the craft they're going to come home in. What's the name of that?
Soyuz craft. But the Bessemer engines, if they ever get that up there, they'll attach that to the Z1 structure, and they'll be able to fire that, like, for, you know, days or weeks on end. And that's an ion-type engine that's eventually planned. They thought they were going to have that by now, but it's probably a couple of years away.
And that's a lot more efficient. Yeah, Soyuz, to use the Soyuz thrusting, I'm amazed by that because you want to make sure it's got enough thrust to bring you back home to do a deorbit burn. You guys have just listened to TechNet number 1572 and Space Report number 165. We'll be back next week. Hope you enjoy it. Be kind to each other. This is the fun stuff. This is a hobby. Don't take it too serious. Hey, John, keep those lads and cards and letters coming. And it looks like we're designing brand new test equipment here, John. KC2WGB, KQRIW, the test net, TechNet.
And they used to do with the shuttle, Dick, with the fuel, too. I used to think that was weird, but they always figured it, well, we got enough to get back.
Yeah, the shuttle had a lot of spare, but I don't think the Soyuz has that much spare. It looks like a very Spartan craft to me. You got it, John.
Thank you, Dick, and thanks for a great night. Good night tonight. Yeah, keep the questions coming. We're enjoying them. And we're going to explain all of this stuff next week. Okay, we're a little behind this. I want to thank everybody for joining us. And everybody, be safe and be kind. Like we say, it's a hobby. KC2WGB.
John, are you promising that we're going to get all the answers next week? And therefore, there'll be no more tech nets after that? Everybody will know everything? Is that the promise you just made, John?
Yes, and all the space answers, too, that have been coming up. All the stuff about moving the moon. And yeah, we're going to answer. Next week will be everything.
We'll be able to come back.
Wow. However, whenever you fly a spacecraft like Planck and WMAP and whatever, and you think you're going to get all the answers, you suddenly find out, ooh, wait a minute now. I didn't expect to see that. It's more complicated than you think. So each time you think you're getting answers, you get a few answers, but you get twice as many new questions. Mother Nature did not set up this universe to be easy for mankind to understand it. I don't think we've been given that much emphasis. Bye-bye, you all. Be humble. We're not that significant in this universe. KQRIW clear.
You're right, Dick. I think Mother Nature set up my lab, too, because I get more questions than answers. Have fun, guys. KC2WGB clear.
KC2WGB, WHYY. Just letting you know the band is opening. I can hear you full quieting on the input.
Yeah, me too. And my television is going crazy tonight. How's yours doing, Joe?
I logged some more news stations this morning. What do you think?
But did any of the stations you used to watch fade out because of co-channel interference?
Absolutely. In fact, it was so bad tonight, I was scanning up and down through the band. Early this morning, Channel 7, 11, and 13 couldn't see them from New York. They were getting crammed from stuff in Baltimore area. Later on this evening, I couldn't identify the other station that was killing it, but something was killing Channel 21. Couldn't get that one in either.
Yeah, every so often, like this morning, I get up and I scan the channels, and so many of the channels are blank. And I said, oh, have I had a failure in my system? And then do a little more searching, and you find out what's going on. Huh. And by the way, one of the things I've discovered is that Radio Shack, when it comes to the design of their set box digital converter, boy, they did a beautiful job. I mean, there's various methods by which it gives you a signal strength indicator, It gives you electronic programming guides. It gives you the future electronic programming guide. You can tell what's coming up for the next few hours or even three-quarters of the day or even the whole damn day. Some of the modern TV sets being sold now do not give you future electronic programming guides. They do not give you a field strength indicator. All they say is a weak signal. And on top of that, the electronic program guide prints across the screen with such fine print that without your binoculars, you can't even read it. So some of the new sets have got some nice features, but we've lost a couple of things from what that old Radio Shack thing did. I imagine your Septon converter has some nice features that you like. Over to you, Paul, K2LAW.
Paul, I thought Paul signed out already, or disappeared. Anyway, now I have a different set-top converter than you have, and I've told you what model I have already. It doesn't do all the same stuff you have available in yours, but I use mine primarily for DXing. How about you?
Yeah, for the last few days, I've been using the wrong name on almost everybody. Sorry about that, Joe. Okay, bye-bye, you see you later. K2RIW cleared.
Repeater, you set off. 73W2RY.
Disconnected.
Thank you for visiting the Pilot Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link clear.
Auto connecting.
Node number 9126.
Welcome to the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link active.
Because if it, I did use it, there's no value. So
Leslie collects all kinds of stuff, so
it makes no difference. Just, I like to have stuff that I can, in the warehouse I got a few things, but that's in the warehouse, I just don't have room here. I believe that was Bill, Pine Barrens out there. Morning, Bill. Over to you, sir, KC2WB.
Damn, there's a long squatch tail on this. Good morning, John. Good morning, Todd. Good morning, Wes. Kilo 2 Golf Buck, thank you. How you guys are doing this morning? I just had it on scan. As a matter of fact, I was talking. I hope I wasn't bothering you guys. The way the band has been like buku band openings. And I was actually on this frequency talking on another, thank God for PLs. I was talking to a guy down in Southern Maryland. I think it was on the, Chestertown, Maryland repeater. And I'm glad I wasn't interfering with you guys. Sometimes with the band opening, especially if some repeaters aren't PL'd and stuff, it gets pretty hairy. And I know I've already talked to Cape Cod twice today, and last night I was on Simplex going all the way down to Virginia Beach with my little 2-meter setup here. HF, that's not much, but 2 meters, it's quite a shot. Anyway, I wanted to ask you guys something, and I'm sure one of you guys will know it. John probably will know it. If he doesn't, I'm sure somebody else does. The 147-000, I believe that repeater was on the Chrysler building at one time. I heard you guys on it earlier tonight. And I don't know, I used to be able to key that thing up. And I don't know whether there's something happened to it or whatever, but I couldn't get you guys. I don't even know what PL it is anymore. I thought I had the right PL, but it doesn't answer me anymore. Is there something up with that? And if so, maybe one of you guys can give me the PL.
Yeah, the repeater is out of service right now. It wasn't active tonight. We were using the reverse mode on it and talking Simplex on the same frequency, but the repeater is not operational.
That answers a lot of questions. Good. Okay, I guess it's still up on the Chrysler building, or is this a defunct repeater that will not be back on, or are we just waiting for them to fix it?
I don't know. I haven't talked to Steve about it. Today is the first time I noticed the repeater was down. So when I talk to Steve, I'll find out. I know he has another location. He has another repeater up at the same frequency. I think it's a different PL, though. I'm not sure of that PL. But he may have this one back online. I'm not sure. But I know he was in process of removing it from the location. But you're right. It's on the Chrysler building. But whether or not he's going to put it back in operation, I don't know that.
Okay. Yeah, that's a very difficult building to have a repeater on just because of the shape of the building, and it's very, very, very tough to actually get in there to work on anything. And I know for another friend of mine up there has a repeater on top of that, a 440 repeater, and he's always complaining about how, they have a hard time, he has a hard time getting in there to work on it, and because of the shape of the building and stuff, it's a very hard building to put a dipole or any kind of antenna on, except for the top spire, I guess. Anyway, well, thanks for answering my question. I thought I was going crazy, because I know that I've talked to you on that repeater, John, and for some reason, it wasn't coming up. I'm saying, well, maybe they changed PLs, and I just don't have the right PL. So, all right. Very well. Anyway, good morning. I don't know what the topic of conversation is, but like I said, I was just scanning the bed and heard you guys and figured it's safe.
Yeah. Real quick, it was operating 27 hours ago because I tripped it, and it's good to hear you.
On. What is the PL? I'll check my list and see if I have the correct PL. You know it offhand.
I think it's 1365. I just hit the buttons. I think it's 1365.
Okay. Yeah, I think that's what I had. I think that's what I had when it was working, but for some reason. All right. That's cool. At least I know one of these days, if they ever turn it back on, maybe it'll be the new improved, and it'll be for me to hit.
Yeah, I programmed the front radio last night. That was one that I put in there in about 27 hours ago. I tripped it, so I know it was operating.
That's why it's down, but
believe I'll find out what he's doing.
I heard Todd and I heard the tail end of you, John, to the call on both ends.